So I'd like to begin the talk this afternoon with a personal experience. And it might raise some expectations saying that. So it's quite an ordinary experience. And this was happening to me during a work retreat that we run every year for the last 12 years in a leprosy community in India. So does anyone know the word leprosy? Finnish for leprosy?
Lepra.
So community of people that have had the disease, most of them are cured, but they have the effects of the disease are still there, both physically, the disabilities and the social discrimination that happens to people that have that disease. So that's why they all live together in a community. And we go there every year with a group and run a work retreat there where we work with the people in the community, both joining in their work, working with them in the fields, in their workshops, in the kitchens, and also doing some service work in areas that don't usually get attention, like the old people's home. So the place where those people in the community that can't work anymore go to live and to receive a little bit more help. And so we do a lot of work there. And so that's kind of the background to the personal experience. And so this last work retreat, which was in December, I was training some of the especially one lady who was working in the old people's home to use a special wheelchair that someone in our group had bought the previous year. And so the people who work in the old people's home, they themselves have leprosy, or had leprosy, so they're not exactly kind of strong, fit, and many times also they're quite elderly as well, so it's a bit confusing kind of who's in what role. But anyway, I was training this lady how to use this special wheelchair, which was a wheelchair that could have the back come back completely flat, so that people who are bedridden could then be moved onto the wheelchair quite easily and taken to the bathroom and the shower. And for us, in our cultures, this sounds very straightforward and obvious. What we were learning, this was the second year we were doing this training. Hello. Special guest. Mm-hmm. Great. So what we realized, this was the second year we were trying to do the training, was that it was actually very, very far from what they felt comfortable doing. So things like, you know, pushing on handles or putting brakes on, just beyond the realm of experience of what these women were used to. And so it needed a lot of dedication. So we tried it 1 year for a week and it didn't work. And so this time, this December, it was okay. We do it every day for the whole 3.5 weeks that we're there. Every day we're going to train, every day we're going to train, every day we're going to train. And this is still the background. What it meant for me was that I had to go to the old people's home every day. So we have silent days on the retreat where we meditate. We have unscheduled days because it's a long retreat and it's 3 weeks. We have unscheduled days where people can just do their own thing. And I had to go every day. So this is really interesting. Yeah, obviously it's something I'm doing because I want to, and I'm choosing to, and I love it. But going every day kind of makes it a little bit like work. And so the group of us, we would have our breakfast together in silence in the guest house we were staying. And then, you know, we would each, when we were ready, go off to our workplace, wherever that was, to do our work. And almost every day, as I finished breakfast and I would set off to the old people's home, I would find that, maybe not every day, but on many days, I would have some kind of resistance there. You know, there'd be some kind of, oh, you know, I really want another cup of tea, you know. Or, you know, everyone else gets a day off, you know, I should get a day off. You know, everyone should get a day off. I really want to have a day off. I'm really tired today, you know. Maybe I can just crawl back into bed. You know? So every day, or many days, there'd be this kind of resistance to the kind of going off, to go and do this, to do this training, to then work with the old women. And what was interesting, that, you know, every day, because of the context, because of the place, I would push through that. You know, I have some witnesses here that can bear witness that I went every day. I would push through the resistance and go. And usually within just a few minutes, you know, of walking out of our guest house towards the old people's home, it's probably about a five minute walk, something like that. Very quickly on the way, something would happen. You know, someone would smile at me, or I would just look up and see the beauty of the morning, or I would pass the hostels where there's two boarding schools there for children with visual impairments and hearing impairments. I would pass the hostels and see the children playing. You know, something would happen and it would touch me and I'd open up. And the experience would be a change from that kind of me-based experience, you know, my tiredness, my cup of tea, my day off, whatever it is, to us-based, you know, to the bigger picture. It would vary, and every day, every time this would happen, you know, that every time there'd be this contraction, pushing through, going out, and something would come, and the openness would be there, and be like, ah, you know, this is what it's about. And so, on many levels, like I was saying at the beginning when I said a personal experience and said, like, it's a very ordinary experience, yeah? It's not some kind of, like, you know, mind-blowing meditation experience of oneness or, you know, some kind of big deal. It's a very ordinary experience of just very simple everyday things. And I feel that here we can see it quite a lot over the days here because of the form of this retreat. And I just want to kind of point out some things because it's ordinary and every day, we don't usually see it in that way. So just watching parents with their children, this is the big one. Just watching parents with their children. You know, it's a very everyday thing. Yeah, we see it probably for most of us every day of our lives in some small form. And we take it for granted, but what is actually happening internally there? What is actually happening there? That commitment to the love, you know, that commitment to the care of the children, even when we don't, I'm not a parent, I can't say we, even when they don't feel like it, even when tired, grumpy, sick, no days off. So we see it here every day in this retreat, in this context. And we also, even if, you know, even those of us who are not parents, we also know this, these kind of experiences for ourselves, when something is important enough that we push through. That we push through the resistance or the kind of me-based aspects of ourselves. So kind of that not giving in to the me and mind voices and putting into practice what really is of most value to us, what really matters to us the most. And that allows a whole world to open. It allows a whole world to open. And it can be really interesting because I know there's a lot of parents here and they probably don't see themselves in this way, you know, in the daily life. We don't see it. And for all of us, it's like that. We don't see the things that we do in this way. We don't see that capacity that we have, that loyalty that we have to things that we love, to people that we love, to things that matter to us. And so I really want to highlight that this afternoon, to look at that from the perspective of Dharma practice. And another example that kind of came up over the days, this was something that somebody shared, a very kind of similar thread here, is, you know, a sense that, you know, I've come here to practice, to meditate, and I've done retreats before. And then I come here and the experience of meditation isn't what I thought it would be. You know, it's not what I'm used to. You know, the depth I remember from previous retreats maybe isn't there, or the calmness or the quietness. And then going and helping to look after the children, and something there shifts. And there's like, suddenly there's the depth. Suddenly there's the kind of gatheredness of attention. Suddenly there's the insight and the opening. And so what's important to see there is that intention, that dedication, were there all along to the practice. Yeah, that intention, that dedication were there all along to the practice. That interest to deepen, to understand life, to cultivate the wholesome, is there. And so the form is different. The form of between sitting in silence, looking in, or being with the children, playing, being with them. It's a different form. But the intention is the same. And so with that same intention, also the fruits can be the same. So the insight or the depth can come in a different set of circumstances. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So that was all an introduction. And I'd like to speak more today about a quality called Viriya, V-I-R-I-Y-A, another Pali word that you don't need to remember, that very much is at the root of this kind of process that I've been trying to give examples of, that process of dedication, that process of energy that we give to things that matter to us. It's very much at the root of this. And this quality is another one of the paramis that Nathan mentioned yesterday. So he mentioned one of the lists of the Buddha liked lists. So one of the lists was the paramis, these qualities that are really qualities that take us all the way on our journey. And they're also the kind of qualities that root us, connect us most deeply to what is most important in our lives in the here and now. So they do both. And so Nathan was speaking about generosity, and I'm going to speak about Virya, which is usually translated as energy. And it's a quality, yeah, that really supports us in staying true to our deepest aspirations. The deepest, deepest, deep of our depth. The thing that, things that really, really matter to us. And it also helps us to break through our habits of giving in and giving up. You know, these habits of giving in to the me and mine, these habits of you know, tiredness, laziness, not wanting, not liking, whatever it is. So it really, it has really these qualities of helping us break through that. And when we think about this word energy, it really is, it's actually at the core of everything we do. You know, everything we do in life, physical, mental, emotional, physical, needs energy. Yeah, it needs energy. So it's really at the core of everything that we do. And yet it can get quite confusing what it actually is. And so how we understand it is really important. And how we apply it is really important. Because it can be, if you understand it a certain way, it can be a real source of joyful interest and of kind of aliveness. And if we understand it another way, it can be a source of frustration and a lot of discouragement, actually, despair. So quite interesting to look at it in that way. It's quite kind of polarized how we understand. So I want to go into a little bit more the kind of different nuances or meanings that this word virya has in the Pali and using English translations. It has quite a lot of meanings, quite a lot of nuances, such as strength, courage, energy, which I've already said, effort, perseverance also, perseverance and persistence. Are they all more or less clear? Yeah. And again, on a very basic level, what it means, and I'll keep coming back to that, on the basic level, what it means is the power to do something and the power to stick with something, yeah, that we're doing. So on a very basic level, that's what virya means. But then it has kind of nuances, it has subtleties that are interesting. So the first aspect of it is the aspect of strength. One of the meanings that it has is strength. And what is this strength? It's the strength or the power to channel our energy into developing wholesome qualities and wholesome states of mind. So, you know, we've been talking about this a lot, the wholesome, the skillful, as opposed to the unwholesome and the unskillful, things that lead to well-being of ourselves and others. So in this example that I gave from Anandawan from the leprosy community, we can say that ability to channel the energy that was there into staying steady with the wish to serve, the wish to give, you know, with generosity. So channeling the energy into that rather than letting it flow into the kind of more, maybe I should have another cup of tea. I love tea, in case you didn't know that. It's a good example for me. Maybe I should have another cup of tea, or maybe I should, you know, take the day off or whatever. So that channeling of energy into that which is wholesome. You know, in parenting, it's really clear, but I'll say it, you know, the obvious thing of continuity, of staying steady with the love and the best intentions that we have for the children, even when things are difficult. You know, maybe sometimes even when we need to be firm, yeah? So it's channeling the energy into what is wholesome rather than necessarily what is easy or what is the pattern. And on retreat, in meditation practice, it's rousing the energy to stay alert and present. For example, when there's, you know, dullness or tiredness in the body or mind. So kind of bringing the energy into the practice, rousing the energy, creating the energy. Or when there's restlessness, the energy to come back, the energy to be, the energy to stay with the practice. So the second kind of meaning or element of virya is courage. In some traditions, I think both Nathan and I like this image, they speak about practice is like spiritual warriorship. You know, being a warrior has got a very kind of martial arts kind of energy to it. So that courage to meet challenges, so the courage to meet challenges on our path, for the sake of that which we're working towards, for the sake of our deepest aspirations. So knowing, yeah, there are challenges. You know, we don't only meditate when it's easy. We don't only meditate when we want to. There's one teacher, I think it's, maybe it's Tanisara Bhikkhu, I'm not sure, who says, you know, if we only meditated when we felt like it. Is that him? If we only meditated when we felt like him, like it, then we'd only know how to meditate. We'd only cultivate the skill of meditating when we feel like it. And then when life throws difficult things at us, we wouldn't have that resource. So we're practicing also, we're bringing the energy also in when we don't feel like it. So that resource deepens for us and becomes a resource that we can really rely on, because we can't rely on life. You know, life is uncertain, and for sure things are going to happen that we don't want or we don't like or we're not prepared for. So channeling the energy, using the energy to meet challenges for our own well-being, to develop our own resources, and for the sake of our deepest aspirations, so that we really have the deepening according to what we really want, what we really aspire to. So again, many times, whether in the example I gave from my own experience or on the meditation cushion or in other situations in our life, accepting that things like tiredness or laziness will arise, and often they have good reason, you know, might not have slept well. But not being defined by them. You know, not being defined by that. Okay, there's tiredness, or there's laziness, or there's some need there. But that's not the only thing that is present. That's not the only thing that I am. That's not the only thing that I have access to. There's also my aspiration. There's also my love for my children. It can be a helpful reflection. Often, it's used a lot in the Buddhist tradition, hasn't come so much to the West because we tend to have quite complex relationships with our parents, but reflecting on all that our parents have done for us. Yeah? Reflecting on all that our parents have done for us as a teaching. And yeah, in the West, some of us find that a bit tricky, but that doesn't mean it's not a useful practice. As a teaching, you know, all the times they got up in the night when we were babies, you know, all the times they went to work to earn money so that we would have this or that, whatever, lots of examples. All the times they fed us, very simple, washed us. So accepting what's here without being defined by it, that's the courage in Virya. There may be things here that make things more challenging, but it's not everything that's here. So this quality of courage really is many times going against our habits, going against our patterns of kind of giving up and not extending our limits. And there's a beautiful quote from Ajahn Tajaniya, who's one of the teachers that I think teach in Naroda quite regularly. And he says, avoiding difficult situations or running away from them does not usually take much skill or effort. In other words, we all know how to do that. But doing so prevents us from testing our own limits and from growing. The ability to face difficulties can be crucial for our growth. However, If you are overwhelmed by difficulties, you should step back for the time being and wait until you have built up enough strength to deal with the difficulties skillfully. In other words, he's telling us to pick our battles. Or rather, you know, to be skillful about where we put bring energy and to what degree. So acknowledging that there's some situations where something is too much for us. And that's okay. It's really about the balancing of testing our limits, seeing where we can expand, seeing where we can grow, and seeing where we actually need to listen, to care for ourselves. So bringing a balance to this quality of bringing energy, channeling energy, and of effort. So another meaning of virya, which you may have heard when I read the whole list, is effort. And yeah, it's effort is a word that I'm slowly bringing more into the teaching. Kind of sometimes find that a lot of us Western teachers are hesitant about using it. And that's because for most of us, we have a lot of connotations around that word, around the word effort. We have a lot of, many times, a lot of tightening around this word effort. And in a way, when we explore this aspect of virya, this aspect of effort, we actually need to start fresh. To kind of, if we feel like we have a lot of connotation around it, we have very rigid understandings about what it is, then it can be helpful to kind of start from the beginning, like press the refresh button on the computer and start again to really understand what's our relationship to effort and how can we nurture it to be skillful. So when we speak about effort in practice, it's not a forcing and it's not a tensing. But it does take determination, it does take kind of presence, it does take a gathering of ourselves. And it is a really worthwhile exploration, real worthwhile exploration for us to explore effort for ourselves, what that means. One way of exploring it is through the body, is to feel what happens in the body when I gather my energy, when I channel my energy, when I kind of make effort to be present, to be with what is, to be with discomfort, to be with tiredness, whatever it is, or to push through something. So to feel into the body, is there tension? Where is it? Is it possible to relax it? Have I suddenly gone, you know, is all my energy gone into the head? And I'm kind of like trying. That actually is a verb that we use, efforting. And made up in meditation, Dharma language. Efforting. It's like this. You know, is that what we're doing? Is there a shoulding? I should get through this. Oh, the teacher said we should push through. So really kind of becoming more familiar with it, checking in the body, checking the quality of the mind, seeing if we can spread the awareness through the body so that we come into contact with the wider sense of our being. What we can discover when we bring the attention into the body, that there can be this kind of like active efforting of like trying really hard. And then when we connect to the level of our aspiration, the level of our love, the level of why we're actually practicing, then beneath that or deeper than that, there can be actually a sense of some deep harmony and well-being. If I go back to my original example of this kind of almost daily ritual of needing to get up from breakfast and go, what sustained that would be the ability to feel something that was deeper than that wish for a cup of tea or to go back to bed or to have a day off. Yeah, so deeper than that. And that is something that when we connect to that, that actually feels really good. Yeah. That deep harmony, a deep sense of well-being. It's kind of like tapping into a well that's there. And we can get like inklings of it, you know, like glimpses, whispers. And slowly with practice, we can rely on it more. We have a more reliable access to it, connection to it. And I don't want to kind of embarrass the parents too much, but obviously that's what's happening with parenting. You know, that accessing that deeper love, you know, beyond the daily hardship. Not easy being a parent, beyond the daily hardship, beyond the daily push and pull. So we access that deeper sense of harmony, that deeper sense of well-being, that deeper sense of love. And it's also that sense of harmony, that love, that well-being that gets nourished when we push through our limitations. This is the interesting thing, it's a cycle. And again, if I use that example of like pushing through the resistance, going out and then seeing the children play and then like, and that gets nourished because it's not about me in that way. And it goes really deep. And so playing with the effort levels, playing with the effort. If we notice that we have too strong an idea or an agenda of what I should be or where I should get, then that's an indication to soften. If we notice that we're constantly drifting off or confused or losing connection, that's an indication that we need to gather ourselves more. You know, to bring more energy into just this gathering back onto the breath, gathering back into the body, gathering back into metta practice, whatever we're using, into our intention for being here. And this is an ongoing process as we respond to changing conditions. Slept well, didn't sleep well, ate too much, ate too little, you know, all these things are affecting us. Connected to the teachings, didn't connect to the teachings, you know, all these things affect us, influence us. So we're constantly responding, we're constantly playing with what's here. Before the gathering started, I think just a few hours when we arrived, at some point Anna said to me, oh, isn't this great? We'll hear people playing the piano this time, and I think I've heard people play the guitar. And one of the images that we use for, that the Buddha used for this tuning, this play, was tuning a musical instrument. So our relationship to effort, to energy, is like that. You know, we're constantly tuning. And if you play a musical instrument, then you know, you don't just tune it once in your life. You know, you have to come back again and again and tune it because the conditions affect it. It changes. It's the same with us. Quite nice to see ourselves as a musical instrument that needs tuning, makes beautiful music. Another interesting part of this is that the cycle of energy and effort is mutually supportive. So sometimes making some effort can bring energy. And I'm sure some people have had this experience. Sometimes I've certainly had it, sit for 45 minutes and the mind is all over the place, you know. It's just like, you know, waste of time. No, sit longer. And bring effort, sit longer. And then the mind settles. It just needed more time. So the effort to stay steady, to sit longer. And sometimes the practice only starts later. Sometimes effort can bring energy. And many times energy can support effort. So we bring more energy by, for example, being with the in-breath, watching the in-breath and the way the body's energized with the in-breath. And then that helps us have more energy. It helps us to stay more with the breath or to stay more in the body instead of drifting off. And so there's different ways to arouse energy, and these are important, and I'm just going to give some. And as always, you're invited to explore your own. So one really simple way of arousing energy, of creating energy in the body, is to reestablish the posture. So often, you know, as we're sitting, what happens is our body will go back to some natural way of, usually for most of us, slumping. So we reestablish the posture. That's fine that it's doing this, but it's making our energy low. We reestablish the posture. We come back to feel the uprightness of the back, to feel the openness in the chest, the receptivity, the relaxation. That can really change the experience, just something really simple and basic like that. We reflect on our intention of why we're here. We reflect on our deep aspirations. That can also bring energy. Connects us, you know, not just this moment-to-moment dullness, but okay, this is why I'm here. We remember our own goodness and worthwhileness, our own value. It also really helps. One of the tips the Buddha gave for this was to reflect on our own generosity. The connection to Nathan's talk yesterday. He decided not to bring that part in, and he said, oh, it'll come, and it snuck in today. So reflecting on our own generosity is actually a way of inspiring us, of arousing energy, and also of calming the mind, actually. Because it, when we reflect on our own acts of generosity, it usually makes us happy. And that naturally calms the mind, but in an energized way, not a dull way. And remembering what is possible for us. So inspiration. Remembering what is possible for us. So inspiration, either experiences we've had in our own practice that inspire us to continue, or teachings we've heard, or people we know. Things that remind us of what is possible, of what our potential is, of what we are able to do and achieve. And bringing that in. So doing all of this, both in our practice and beyond our practice in our lives, really empowers us to go beyond what we think our limits are. This is really important. To go beyond what we think our limits are in life, in practice. And that in turn goes beyond the limits of our personal self. It's not just about us. It allows us to be in the world, to act in the world that, in a way that touches and affects the lives of others. So I'd like to end with another personal experience. And this was when we were in Israel and Palestine in October. So we run a work retreat every year. In Palestine, helping Palestinian farmers during the olive harvest, farmers that have issues accessing their land because it's close to Jewish settlements or army outposts or the roads. And this October, just a week before the retreat was beginning, a wave of violence started in Palestine and Israel. And I don't know, I'm assuming most people here are lucky enough, fortunate enough not to know in too much detail what is happening. But it was just beginning, and no one knew how it was going to unfold. And so this was exactly a week before we were starting the retreat. And there was a lot of concern around us, both, you know, from friends and family in Israel and from friends and family abroad. Were we still going to go into Palestine and spend 2 weeks there? Was that still the plan? And for us, it was pretty clear that it was still the plan. That in that kind of situation, it was even more important to prioritize friendship and to prioritize care and to prioritize community. And we were in constant touch with our Palestinian friends in the village where we stay, as well as with kind of the network of NGOs that we're part of that work in Palestine, to kind of really keep an eye, keep an ear, know what was going on, so that we wouldn't be responsible for bringing others into a dangerous situation. And so we came to the village and we stayed there. And it was quite different to previous years, even though as far as the Palestinian population was concerned, it was very quiet. There was no violence at all. There was more presence of the Israeli military and the Jewish settlers than there had been in previous years. And especially at night, that would kind of be in our awareness. And one night, just before we went to bed, as we were already in silence, the group was already in silence, and we were brushing our teeth, I saw these lights in the sky going up, and I recognized them as flares that the military sends up to make light when they're about to do something. And I was lying in bed, kind of feeling the sense of concern and fear and uncertainty after that. And yet feeling so clear, that sense of friendship and solidarity and what really mattered. To be there with those that have no choice but to be there. And to be a presence of peace, of sanity, of love, of compassion, in a situation which is completely crazy and unjust. And our retreat is called Being Peace. It's about bringing that quality of peace, of calm, of compassion that we cultivate on the cushion into these kind of situations. What we discovered, all of us as individuals and as a group, was that we had an inner resilience and an integrity that really supported us. I remember one person telling us how she was sitting at the airport in the UK about to board the plane to come on the retreat, and she was watching the fear come up and just working with it. It's just fear. It's just fear. It's just fear. It would go down. And once we were there, it's always the interesting thing, everyone felt like they wouldn't want to be anywhere else than where we were. To be there in the midst of life to be a manifestation of friendship. So bringing energy to align ourselves with what matters. We do that moment by moment in our practice. And then it's a resource for us when things are difficult, when things are hard. Whether it's unexpected coming from life to us, or whether we choose to go into situations of difficulty to make a difference. During and after the retreat, many people asked me, as an Israeli, if I wasn't afraid and what my experience was in the village. And what was completely mind-blowing, even after 10 years of going into Palestine and doing these retreats, was this time, even more than before, the sense of friendship, of care and appreciation. Farmers that we've known for years, this year were too afraid to go into the groves on their own. And so being there made a real difference. And that was really the deepening of the love and the friendship. People in the village, shopkeepers wouldn't let us pay for things in shops. One time Nathan and I were walking down the road and a car stopped, and someone who we'd never met before said to us, "I recognize your faces. You come here every year. I want you to know that this is your home, and you're always welcome here." And so when we offer friendship, it grows both ways, and the friendship in the world grows. So in a way, bringing energy to what matters to us is what our life depends on. And life depends on that, you know. We make a difference, our own lives and the world, again and again. So remembering over the days here, as we practice, as we make the effort, as we choose to come to the hall, as we choose to prioritize deepening, to prioritize presence, to prioritize friendship, love, compassion. As we do that, other people are doing that also, all over the world. And we're connecting to that network. We're part of that network of sanity, that network of peacefulness, that network of compassion. So each moment in our practice where we connect to energy, when we connect to openness, when we're aligned with our intention, is a support to that movement of sanity, of compassion, of wisdom and clear seeing in the world. It's a participation in the deepest type of transformation that is possible. So let's have a few quiet moments together to close. So may we continue to explore the movement of energy through our lives. May we continue to nourish our deepest sense of harmony, of connection. May our practice together be a nourishment for wisdom, for compassion, for peace and justice, for all beings in this world of ours.